Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. California and the rest of the nation are seeing a surge of new COVID-19 cases, which is forcing a new wave of measures to help slow the spread. 11 counties total are now in more restrictive tiers than, well, they were in just 24 hours ago. Three of those, including Sacramento, Stanislaus, and San Diego counties, have shifted back to the most restrictive tier, purple, meaning widespread cases of COVID-19. What does all of this mean for business, getting around, and just your health? Well, here to help walk us through the restrictions and what the best practices are for keeping people safe is the health director for Sacramento County, Dr. Peter Bielenson. Nice to have you back, doctor.
Thanks.
And also the health director for Yolo County, Dr. Amy Sisson. Nice to have you here as well.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Dr. Bielenson, I'm going to start with you. Sacramento County was just demoted from red to purple yesterday. How is that? How does all that play out? Is it an instant change?
Well, it is an instant change. We're actually doing our health order on Friday, but yes, it occurs quickly. I should point out that there are two metrics that are used for giving the color tiers. One is the percent positivity of tests, in which we are orange. We're actually the second best, but that we are purple by a small margin in the cases per 100,000. So we're about 9.4 cases per 100,000. The cutoff is 7, but compared to what's going on in the Midwest, where it's 80s, 90s, 100, it's quite different. So we're kind of boxed into the situation. And the different color, going to purple color, means that things like movie theaters, restaurants, gyms, churches, et cetera, have to go outdoors instead of being indoors as they were allowed to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, do I understand that the county pushed back a bit against the state, saying that the cases of COVID-19, the concentrated cases of COVID-19 in the county were in contained places like nursing homes?
Yeah, we did do that. The nursing homes, gatherings at Halloween, and just general gatherings in people's houses are by far the three most common causes based on our contact tracing. Restaurants are not a major deal, neither are gyms. And so we kind of wanted them to be a little bit more judicious and surgical in how they made their decisions, but they denied us.
Mm-hmm. Do you think restaurants in Sacramento are not a major source of cases because we still have quite a bit of outdoor dining and that's where people tend to sit when they go out to eat?
That's certainly part of it. The other part of it is only 25% of capacity is what you're allowed to use now. And people have been good about using masks and social distancing.
Mm-hmm. That 25%, though, is now down to zero after the call,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, correct.
Uh-huh. How much time do you give businesses to make this adjustment? I know you said that on Friday you'll release something, but what happens if somebody calls out, you know, calls the county and says, hey, I just saw a restaurant with people eating inside. What happens?
Right. So we use a 311 number and we respond to calls of poor behavior, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the restaurants that I've visited over the past several weeks are very good about covering up their mouths, covering their masks, and socially distancing. And but most importantly, if you look at the data, our contact tracers show that restaurants are not a major source of the infection. Again, it's gatherings and nursing homes.
Yeah, I really find it interesting what you said, that the county is actually doing pretty well. If you look at one metric, that we should be in the orange tier, which is where the county was hoping to be by Halloween. That was the whole saying, right? Orange by
right.
Halloween. But because of some other metrics, it's dragged the county into purple.
And we think they're being more restrictive because Thanksgiving is coming up, and I know we're going to talk about it, but that's a major, major source of gathering. And I view Thanksgiving as the most dangerous day of the 10 months that we've been in the epidemic so far.
Mm. I do want to come back to you on that, but first I want to bring in Dr. Sisson. Dr. Sisson, your county maintained its red status, but you don't think that's going to be for long.
That's right, Randall. We We were able to stay in red this last week with a case rate of 6.7, which is just under the cutoff of 7 for purple. But just since Monday, when the state did that assessment, we've seen our case rate per 100,000 residents increase to 8.9, which lands us solidly in purple if that trend continues. And we added 51 cases yesterday. And then the number that's needed on a daily basis for us to move to purple would be around 15. So we're significantly over that in our most recent cases.
Dr. Sisson, I imagine watching these numbers, you and Dr. Bielenson and other health leaders throughout the state watch these numbers the way many of us were watching election results, constantly refreshing our pages, right? When you see counties surrounding you tick up, I imagine that is concerning because the borders are porous, especially between Yolo and Sacramento counties.
Absolutely. You know, no county is an island, and people move back and forth across these political boundaries all day long without even realizing that they're doing it. So certainly we get concerned when we see cases across the region increasing, because that's where we see movement throughout our region in terms of people in their day-to-day lives. So absolutely. As the numbers start to go up around us, it's not surprising that we're seeing numbers going up in our own county.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Sisson, with Yolo County in the red tier for the past few weeks, why have public schools in Yolo County not opened even on a hybrid schedule?
Yeah, I mean, that's a choice that each district makes in consultation with their staff as well as with parents. And so our districts have made the decision to move slowly and cautiously for the most part. And while they are allowed to open after a county's been in red for 2 weeks, I think many of them have chosen to be more cautious and continue on distance learning. But that's the decision made at the district level. That's not being made by the health department.
Dr. Bielenson, there are schools that are open in Sacramento County. If they're already open, can they stay open?
Yes, that's the interesting thing. As long as they've opened either by hybrid or just totally in person, they are allowed to remain open. If they've been only online until this time, they must stay online, except that you can go for a waiver for elementary schools.
Let's get to Thanksgiving now, because today's a holiday, Veterans Day. It's not typically a holiday that a lot of people, large families, gather and that sort of thing. But we have a string of those types of events before us in the coming weeks. Thanksgiving, of course, the really big one that's right in front of us. Dr. Bielenson, why do you believe that this coming holiday will likely be the most dangerous day in the pandemic thus far?
Well, partly because we've had pandemic fatigue. I mean, there's been 9 or 10 months of discussion with everybody in the world has heard about masks and social distancing, et cetera. And I think a lot of people, because they don't necessarily see people with COVID, have kind of, again, had pandemic fatigue. And so they're much more likely to gather. So we have two messages to give. The number one message is just for this last period of time before the vaccine becomes available. We're about 5 months away from mass production of vaccine, maybe less. And so there's something on the horizon for people to look at. And so just for this Christmas and this Thanksgiving, just try not to gather except for people from your own family. But if you are going to gather, because you got to do harm reduction as well, there are things you can do. For example, have the Thanksgiving feast outdoors. Do it at lunchtime instead, when it's warmer, instead of at nighttime. Put card tables between people so that there's an enforced social distancing. Things like that can at least hopefully reduce the risk, and being outdoors reduces the risk significantly.
Yeah, we do have the luxury of the California climate this time of year that other parts of the nation do not. We're in a little bit of a cold snap. My former colleagues, when I worked back in Madison, Wisconsin, would laugh that at 62 degrees yesterday, we're calling it a cold snap. But the overnight temperatures were absolutely cold. Dr. Sisson, what are your thoughts on what Dr. Bielenson said. Do you share his opinion that the most dangerous days are ahead of us?
I definitely think that we are concerned in Yolo County about holiday gatherings, and we're taking a very similar approach with our messaging, reminding people that the safest gathering is a virtual gathering. But we recognize that some people are going to choose to gather in person, and so we're trying to arm them with information so that they can make an informed decision about keeping those gatherings safe. So we're encouraging people, if they do choose to gather, to keep their gatherings small, to keep them short, outdoors, to wear masks, and to maintain 6 feet of distancing.
Do you expect to see an uptick in testing prior to Thanksgiving as people, you know, they decide, okay, we're going to get together. We need to find out if, you know, if we're COVID-free before we get together. And if you do expect to see that, do we have enough test kits out there to handle all of that?
Yeah, I do think we are going to see some people choosing to get tested in advance of gatherings. And I think that's a good idea, but I'd like to remind people that, you know, a test is just a point in time, and they could very well become positive the next day. So what is more useful than getting a negative test before people gather is that they really minimize their contacts, in-person contacts, for the 2 weeks before that gathering. So if you are insisting on getting the family together in person for Thanksgiving, then be very judicious in the activities that you choose to do in the 2 weeks going up to Thanksgiving. So that would be staying home a lot more often, not getting together with other groups of friends or family, so that you won't have any exposures that put you at risk on Thanksgiving Day. Getting tested is great, but minimizing contacts for the 2 weeks before is even more important. To your second question, in terms of whether there is enough capacity for testing. In Yolo County, we have a lot of unused testing capacity at this point, so we certainly could handle more people coming in to get tested at our county-run or the state-run sites.
Oh, that's good to hear. Tiffany Hayer with the County Office of Emergency Services in San Joaquin County is asking for more people to get tested, even if they don't have symptoms, to show that they have COVID under control. Dr. Bielenson, in terms of testing, where do you stand on all of this?
Absolutely. We have room for testing. And one of the main groups that needs to get tested are college kids who are coming back at Thanksgiving time. They'll be here for 6 weeks because the colleges are keeping kids home during that break time. And a lot of kids are going to bring the virus back, either asymptomatically without symptoms or with symptoms. And so that's an important test group to get tested. But I agree with Amy that you want to obviously try and quarantine people beforehand if necessary.
So we know that people, despite how much they may hear on shows like Insight or from other outlets that they should not get together at Thanksgiving, we know that they will. So what do you want people to keep in mind as they attend these parties? You know, that voice that's in the back of their head throughout the entire party, Dr. Bielenson, what do you want them to be hearing?
Well, it's what Dr. Sisson was talking about and what I talked about, kind of a combination. Again, outdoors is much better than indoors. Do it during lunchtime so it's warm enough. Have card tables that are going to have a guaranteed 4 or 6 feet on either side to keep people from sitting next to each other. And then the things that Amy said, like shortened visits, again, wear masks except when you're eating, social distancing, et cetera, all those things for those people who absolutely must gather. But again, we really encourage people for just this year not to gather except for your immediate family, because we're gonna be in a much greater state of normalcy very soon. And by next Thanksgiving and Christmas, things will be much, much better.
Dr. Sisson, the urge to hug is going to be high on people will be really wanting to reach out, especially to family members they may not have seen. This has gone through my head. If you hold your breath when you reach in to hug, is it okay? Or is that just one of the most dangerous things you can do?
Yeah, no one's asked me that question before. I think that that might be a way to reduce the risk. But I would continue to discourage hugging for the time being. Air hugs from 6 feet away. Express the sentiment. I know they don't feel as mm-mm. good, but I think, you know, again, as Dr. Bielenson pointed out, we are close to the end of this, but we aren't there yet. But it's really, now's not the time to let down our guard as cases are increasing. So asking people to continue to make these sacrifices for just a little bit longer so we can make it through to when we have a vaccine and things can start to return to normal.
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to say that, but understood.
Sorry.
No, I understand. Health Director for Yolo County, Dr. Amy Sisson, also Health Director for Sacramento County, Dr. Peter Bielenson. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Randall.
All right. And just ahead, we will be talking about how the economy is affected by these change in tiers. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. It was announced this week that President-elect Joe Biden had assembled his COVID-19 task force. The team includes doctors with a California connection. And we did reach out to Dr. Robert Rodriguez, who is on the task force and a UC San Francisco emergency medicine professor. But we were told by the school's public information representative that he was not doing interviews per the Biden team. Vice President Joe Biden has announced that he will make wearing a mask mandatory in all 50 states. He also has said various times that he will let science guide how the pandemic is handled. And here to help us understand what the science is saying is Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease at UC Davis Health, Dr. Dean Blumberg. And Doctor, welcome back to Insight. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what do we know now that we haven't known, you know, since the start of the pandemic? What's changed recently?
Well, I think we've got increasing evidence that masking and social distancing works. The CDC has come out with clear guidance on masking, saying not only does it protect other people from getting infected if somebody's infectious and wearing a mask, but the person wearing the mask is also clearly protected also. And all the numbers are very consistent with this. They're all about 2/3 protection or 70% protection just by wearing a mask.
Mm-hmm. Are you encouraged about the news from Pfizer about a vaccine that has 90% efficacy?
Yeah, I think it's great. You have to put that into context, though, which is that generally only positive news is going to be reported from these vaccine trials. We don't hear about the negative news. And this is very preliminary. We don't have any safety data reported. And we don't know if the vaccine prevents severe disease, hospitalizations. We don't know if it protects those who are most at risk for a severe disease, such as the elderly.
Mm-hmm. Between now and when a potential vaccine becomes widely available, there will need to be efforts in place to help slow the spread of the pandemic. How much impact do you think a task force like the Biden administration is forming could have on fighting COVID-19?
Well, as you mentioned, I think one of the most important things is that this is going to be science-based and evidence-based. And some of our national guidance has not been science-based up to date. And I think one thing that can be done on a national level is if we make mask wearing the norm, we don't need to have a mandate or a law, but just that it's the norm, not that there's two sides, not that some people believe in it and some people don't, but it's the norm. the national norm, I think that'll go a long way towards increasing mask use, so that those who deny science, who say that masks don't work or are dangerous or whatever, those people are going to be marginalized. So those are going to be fringe beliefs, and we're going to have a normalization of science and evidence-based practices.
We saw that work very well in countries like New Zealand, right?
Well, New Zealand did a wonderful job. Of course, they have some advantages being an island nation, so people weren't crossing the borders. But yeah, there was New Zealand was able to eliminate transmission of the virus. We saw that in China, too, where widespread community social distancing and mask wearing resulted in cessation of viral transmission.
Because you're such an expert in infectious disease, I want to ask you about flu season. How does that factor into the discussion? And what do we know about the expectations for this flu season, given all of the other precautions that we're already taking against COVID-19? Might that help, diminish how strong a flu season we might see?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two main considerations. One is that what we can't have with the ongoing COVID pandemic, we can't have a severe flu season on top of that. We just can't. We can't put pressure on healthcare providers and the health system to have hospital admissions and ICU admissions for influenza as well as COVID. So we can't afford to have a severe flu season, and that's why it's more important than ever for everybody to be immunized against influenza this year. But the good news is that with all the social distancing and mask wearing that is going on because of COVID, this will also reduce transmission of other respiratory viruses, such as influenza. And we saw that in the summer, southern hemisphere during their winter, where there were decreased rates of influenza transmission in Australia, in New Zealand, and other southern hemisphere countries.
Yeah, I have not had a cold or flu since March, and nor has anyone that I know. So I guess that's one silver lining, right?
Right. Not only colds and flu, but in areas where this has been studied, we'd see decreased rates of strep throat and gastroenteritis, too, probably because of more of the social distancing and decreased transmission of all these infectious pathogens.
Yeah. Dr. Dean Blumberg, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Health. We really appreciate your insight into all of this. It's always very welcome.
Thank you. And I'd just like to amplify what Dr. Bielenson and Dr. Sisson said, which is that we're going to be in a world of hurt after Thanksgiving unless people really follow these precautions.
Do you agree with Dr. Bielenson that it could be the worst, darkest day of the pandemic?
I think it'll initiate the worst, darkest day, yes. I think the transmission that is certain to occur from these extended family gatherings, we'll notice them in 1 to 2 incubation periods. So in 2 to 4 weeks later. So by Christmas, it has the potential to be a real disaster. And all the models show that we're going to have more than 3 times increase the number of cases and deaths. And by January, we may run out of intensive care unit space. So we're going to want to look back on days like today when all these warnings were given out. And people really need to follow the advice of the public health experts.
Dr. Dean Blumberg with UC Davis Health, thank you.
Thank you.
California health officials announced yesterday that Sacramento County, along with a couple other counties, would be placed in the purple tier status, the state's most restrictive level. The move was wide-reaching with its implications, especially as we head into the winter, and it could force countless businesses, restaurants, houses of worship to again stop or greatly reduce indoor activities. Even public schools that plan to reopen campuses later in the month will have to put those plans on hold, at least for now. Joining us to help understand how demoting tiers impacts the economy is Ioana Marinescu. She's an economist and professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Policy and Practice. Welcome. Great to have you here, Professor.
Happy to be here.
I laughed because I practiced your name a couple of times over and I got it right. And I was just like, oh, this is going to be easy. And then I tried to do it on the air and it didn't come out so easy. So what do you see as the effects of business closures in the economy? And I do want to mention that you've been on the call for the past few guests. And I keep seeing you nod your head like, yes, yes, you were really in agreement with what a lot of the doctors were saying.
Absolutely. So, you know, the key thing is that for a long time, it's been portrayed that we have a trade-off between curbing the virus and the economy. And a lot of research has been coming out showing that by and large, this is not the case, because essentially, as the virus and the infection progresses, people are afraid to go out by themselves, even without regulations, and that kills business. If people are afraid to go out and shop and go to the restaurants because the infection is raging, that's killing business. Mm. And so that's something that you have to remember, that it might seem costly to impose measures like limiting activities indoor. However, to the extent that these measures are able to curb the epidemic, that is what's ultimately going to help the economy recover, is bringing the epidemic under control. And letting it rip, on the contrary, is going to hurt us by, again, making it harder for people to actually go out and consume. And so it is extremely dangerous for people to relax right now around Thanksgiving, like has been said, and Christmas, because this could have dire consequences down the road for the economy. And this is something that we really need to address now. As an economist, I also have to tell you that a recession is something that is very persistent. So unfortunately, once you got in the hole, it is very rare that you're able to recover very quickly from an economic perspective. So the best course of action is prevention.
Mm-hmm. Because it was not economic factors that forced this, but health factors that forced this recession, might this one be easier to get out of? We can get out of it more quickly because we don't have to correct the economic situation that led to it?
So unfortunately, probably not. And the reason is that the recession has been so deep, so many jobs have been lost, that even though you're right, it wasn't an economic factor, and therefore, in principle, once we fix this health crisis, things should go better. Unfortunately, once businesses close, they're not going to reopen from one day to the next. And so they are. And similarly, once a worker is unemployed, it takes somebody a long time to find a new job, especially when there's not a lot of jobs around. So essentially, no matter what the initial shock was, sure, there might be small differences, but this was a very, very large shock. So it will take a long time for the economy to recover. And in fact, the Congressional Budget Office projects a lowered GDP growth for several years going forward. And therefore, again, it's up to us now to, as much as possible, limit this health crisis, because this is what's going to hamper the recovery going forward. And, you know, again, there is no trade-off here. If we are able to control the health crisis, this will help the economy and get us to a stronger recovery. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't think about the most effective ways to control the health crisis. And that's how, you know, it was great to hear from medical experts before on this show about how you might do that. Certainly, we want to try to get the most effective measures for people for something that will curb the virus. But again, it's not a trade-off between curbing the virus mm-hmm. and the economy.
So if I understand you correctly, when you hear calls to bring the economy back, that doesn't necessarily mean open everything up. That means contain the virus so that the economy can come back?
Correct.
Okay. Ioana Marinescu is an economist and professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Policy and Practice. Thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we have been watching the California restaurant industry closely ever since these shutdowns started back in March. We've seen restaurants close down for good, while some were able to survive. Most of all, just barely hanging on, really kind of depended on if they had a really good to-go business going or a large area for people to sit outside. Now in Sacramento, along with a handful of other counties, they're forced to go back to the purple tier, meaning no more indoor dining, which was only 25% capacity to begin with for those red tier counties. And when you add in the fact that the weather has drastically changed in winter, we felt it this week. very cold overnight temperatures in Northern California. It's just the latest punch really in the gut for restaurants. Jot Condi is the president and CEO of the California Restaurant Association, and he's been with us many times since the pandemic started. Thank you for joining us once again. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Randall.
How difficult is it for restaurants in California to manage these shift in tiers? Every time a tier changes, it changes really their model, you know, what they can and can't do.
Yeah, it's difficult, especially when, you know, we learn whether a county slides backwards, you know, usually days before. And typically restaurants need weeks in order to adjust. I mean, I think that there's every once in a while you hear our elected officials talk about, you know, we're going to use not a light switch, we're going to use a dimmer, you know, and slowly, you know, open and close the economy or segments of the economy. And for the restaurant industry, it's basically a light switch. There's, you know, the employees are the ones who are, you know, hurting in addition to the restaurant owners, you know, because there's a lot of uncertainty with our workforce on whether they're going to have a job next week or not. I mean, it's creating sort of a secondary mental health stress related crisis for our workforce and our owners.
Jot, how unique is this method of county tiers to California compared to other places in the nation?
Well, California is very unique because it's done county by county. And you have 58 counties in the state of California, which is quite a few. And, you know, the difference between, let's say, San Diego County and Orange County, which are right next to each other, is wildly different in how those health departments manage, you know, the regulations and the orders and so forth. So it creates all sorts of challenges for restaurants that may have like one or two locations in different counties.
Do you believe that these restrictions are needed, that gathering inside these restaurants is a source of COVID outbreaks?
Well, so we've been consulting with biostatisticians and epidemiologists because, you know, the Sacramento County and San Diego County are two counties just this week that slid backwards into the purple tier. And what we're hearing out of both health departments, and I think we heard earlier in the segment here, is that the restaurants are not a major contributor to the spread. And our epidemiologists are suggesting the same thing. I mean, I think the experts are telling us that even with the vaccine, that this virus is not going to go away, you know, on the immediate horizon, and we're going to have to learn to coexist with it. And the sort of oscillating of opening and closing businesses every time the numbers go up is not sustainable for most small business owners. So we're going to have to figure out a way to learn to coexist with this. And the experts that we're consulting now relative to indoor air quality are suggesting that there are technologies available, air filtration technologies, UV lighting technologies that actually can attack the aerosols and droplets in the air indoors and make it much safer. So we believe that there is an option and a way to allow dining rooms to open, notwithstanding the fact that the numbers in some counties are high.
Would you like to see some sort of governmental support, financial support to put those systems in?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, obviously California doesn't print money, but the federal government does. And I think now that we're starting to see that there are effective technologies for indoor air quality, and these are very expensive. In some cases, the lighting technologies would run a 6,000 square foot restaurant about $20,000. That's a lot. And so absolutely, we would hope to see some sort of government assistance to allow for these technologies to be installed.
Jot, you are right in the fact that Dr. Bielenson did mention that restaurants in Sacramento County have not been a source of any major outbreaks that they've been tracing. I want to know what you make of research out of Stanford University published yesterday in the journal Nature that shows restaurants are among the top locations for what they called super spreader events, especially full service restaurants where people gather in close quarters for extended periods. Did you get a chance to look at that?
I have not seen that study, but I think that we've seen multiple studies that have different conclusions. And certainly, I think if, you know, indoor versus outdoor air quality is an issue. And that's why we think the technologies that are available now can address that. I mean, if you look at Los Angeles County, the restaurant dining rooms have been closed since March. They have not opened up, and we're seeing in that county huge spikes in the spread of the virus. And I think what the doctor said earlier, which is, you know, the super spreading events really are gatherings, and then of course in some cases nursing homes. But in Los Angeles, people gather in living rooms and people's homes pretty regularly, and you know, people let their guard down when they're at their friend's house. In a restaurant setting, it's basically regulated. And you know, so we would suggest that your dining rooms and restaurants that are operating at 25% capacity are probably safer places to gather than someone's living room.
Mm-hmm. How do you see restaurants adapting as we move into the colder months that we're already feeling?
Yeah, it's tough because, I mean, certainly in Southern California, they enjoy a bit better weather during the winter. But in Northern California, Sacramento, certainly we've experienced a cold spell here. That's going to be a challenge, especially since the dining rooms have just been closed. And, you know, you can drive down, let's say, L Street in Sacramento, for example, and see a lot of you know, tables on the sidewalk. But now I think restaurant owners are trying to figure out how do we heat. Mm-hmm. Outdoor heaters now are a thing.
Yeah. 10 degrees can make a really big difference when you're sitting on a patio.
Right. Yeah.
Seems like fast casual places have managed pretty well. Do you think the fine dining scene will eventually come back?
It will, but it'll be a shadow of its former self. I think a lot of the fast casual, you know, takeout restaurants that were already set up with that business model will be well positioned coming out of this. But I think, you know, the heart and soul of the restaurant industry in any community are, you know, the locally owned, you know, dining houses that exist on street corners and, you know, in our downtown areas. And they're the ones that are going to have the hardest go at this. Mm-hmm. You know, many of them have just been limping along with a takeout business or perhaps, you know, some sidewalk, you know, tables, but it's not enough to sustain, you know, their operations. And if this goes on too much longer with closed dining rooms, we're likely to see another wave of permanent closures.
Jot, if we end up getting this potential effective widespread vaccine by the end of spring, what's your prediction? What's your forecast for the restaurant industry under that scenario in California?
Well, I think the economist, and I won't attempt her name, I don't want to butcher it, but I think she alluded to this, that I think once the vaccine comes out, I think consumer confidence will be a huge driver in what the survival of restaurants. You know, when the first shutdown happened, and I guess the first reopening, you know, in talking to restaurateurs in, let's say, the Sacramento area, they said that about 30% of their customers returned. And in many cases, that's because people perhaps don't feel safe about being sort of out or, you know, in a restaurant. And I think with a vaccine, I think people, the psychology will change. Yeah. and hopefully they'll feel safe enough to go out and eat in a restaurant again.
Jot Condi is the president and CEO of the California Restaurant Association. As always, we appreciate you joining us on Insight.
Thanks, Randall.
Still ahead, a California travel journalist joins us with more about how efforts in New Zealand have all but eliminated the existence of COVID-19 in that country. She's currently living there. She also shares a story of personal connections her dad made during World War II on this Veterans Day. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. While California and much of the nation are experiencing a new wave of COVID-19 cases, in some states it's breaking records. And just yesterday, nationally, we saw more than 135,000 new cases, with hospitalizations at their highest level since the pandemic began. And these are not one-day spikes. These are all building on a trend. While this is happening, there are places in the world where, even without an effective vaccine in place, COVID-19 has been brought under control. New Zealand is an example of that, and joining us now is Nevada City-based award-winning author and journalist Diane Covington Carter, who got stuck in New Zealand this past March and has been there since to witness a very different way of handling the pandemic. Welcome to Insight, Diane.
It's great to be with you.
Yeah, I say you got stuck there, but you live there for a portion of the year, so it's not like you didn't have a place to live.
Yeah, when my husband and I got together 11 years ago, he was living in New Zealand full time, and so we started dividing up our year, 9 months in Nevada City, 3 months here. So we normally would come January, leave in April. And of course, this year, that all changed drastically. So.
Yeah. Before I say anything else, I want to say happy birthday.
Thank you.
Am I the first to say happy birthday today?
Actually, my husband said it when I got up very early here. We're 3 hours earlier. And I was so excited. I forgot it was my birthday. He
said happy. Yeah, well, a very happy birthday. And for your birthday, you plan to go out to a restaurant with family and friends later today, which it's Wednesday there, right?
It's Thursday here. We're a day ahead.
That's right. It's Thursday there.
Well, uh-huh. Yeah.
And you can go out to this restaurant because there are no cases of non-quarantined COVID in the country, right?
Yeah, we're normal here. And normal never felt so delicious. We can hug. We can go to restaurants. It's just like life was before COVID. I think there's one case in quarantine. And from the 5 million people in New Zealand, we've had a total of 5 deaths. So that's 5 deaths per million. And I know that the U.S., I looked it up, it, at this point is 741 deaths per million. So I can tell you that being here during this has been such a good experience of what leadership and science can do together, because you know, we got locked down. The borders closed on March 19th. My husband and I were to fly out on April 7th, and everything got canceled. And on the 25th, there was a nationwide lockdown. So everyone stayed home for 4 weeks, period. You know, we luckily could walk down our driveway to the Tasman Sea and walk along the beach. But otherwise, you weren't even allowed to go out of your property.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody followed the rules. And I feel like the leadership of Jacinda Ardern at 40, she just turned 40.
That's your prime minister.
Yeah, the prime minister. She and the health minister had daily updates, and they were completely fact-based, science-based. But she also had a tremendous warmth and encouragement. It was all about Team New Zealand. I'm sorry, I know this is hard, we can do this. You know, she did little Facebook updates with when she just put her toddler to bed and just chatted with everybody. And I feel like her leadership really, really made a huge impact, and people were willing to follow her.
She set a tone of unity.
She did. She set a tone of unity. And so we had 4 weeks of lockdown in level 4, which was our highest level. And then we went into level 3 for about 2.5 weeks. And that was social distancing, restaurants only having takeout, which was new because during lockdown, nothing was happening there. And then after 2.5 weeks of that, we went to level 2, which was restaurants were open with a small number of people. We actually went to a quiz night, which is big here. You had to keep your social distance. And there was also a really good contact tracing with your cell phone, where when you went in somewhere, you just clicked on this little thing on the door and it recorded who you were and that you were there.
Oh, wow. And then so that's interesting. So you go into a store or a restaurant and it takes a picture of you. People know that you've been there. So if there's an outbreak, they can directly go back and say, this person, and this person was here at that time.
Yeah, you hold up your cell phone to like a barcode on the door, and the cell phone takes a picture of the barcode, or the barcode takes a picture of your cell phone, whatever. And so it's recorded who you were and what time you were there. And so if there were to be an outbreak, you would be notified through your cell phone. It was very, very amazing.
Interesting.
So, yeah. Now,
how walled off? So it is an island. We have to say that.
Two islands, right?
How walled off is it in terms of incoming flights, people leaving and coming back, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, the borders got closed on March 19th. That was the first thing before the lockdown. Returning New Zealanders are allowed to come back, but they go into a 2-week quarantine, which is monitored by the government. And so, you know, they're not allowed to leave their rooms except to maybe walk around outside. And so just returning Kiwis at this point, and there's a lot of them returning. There's like half a million Kiwis, that want to come back.
They want to come back to normal life. Okay, so you have a couple of pieces that you've written about your time in New Zealand during this very unusual period, and people can find those at the Napa Valley Register and on your website, links to them there on your website. And we'll include all that at capradio.org. But I want to get to, it's Veterans Day, and I want to, I want you to speak about an award-winning book that you've written called Finding Gilbert, A Promise Fulfilled. This story is about a young boy your dad met while serving in France during World War II. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was born in the baby boom after the war. And my father used to tell stories about his time in France. And because he was an engineer for the Navy, a Seabee, he was actually building a camp and repairing bridges. He wasn't actually fighting, you know, with a gun, although he had a gun. So he would tell these sweet stories about how kind the French were and how grateful they were. But the most poignant story was about a little boy named Gilbert. He always pronounced it the French way. It's Gilbert, but who lived next door to the camp, and he was an orphan, and how my dad started out by taking him through the food line because the Navy had great food and lots of it. And the little boy, Gilbert, was so skinny. And my dad grew up on a farm, so he hated to see skinny people. He hated to see food go to waste. So the whole thing started around food. And then Gilbert and my dad just got really close during those 5 months. Gilbert started hanging around and riding around in the Jeep with my dad. And one of my dad's jobs was to drive down, he was Omaha Beach, you know, the American landing, to drive down and unload the ships, and Gilbert went with him. So dad tried to adopt Gilbert and wasn't able to. And so he would tell that story, and I could hear it in his voice, even as a child, that there was something very sad and wistful there.
Right.
So
and this is all like pre-Facebook or any way to keep meaningful contact, right?
We're talking about the 1950s,
right?
You know, So just fast forward to 1991, my father is very sick with cancer. And we noticed that when he talked about his time in the war, he would really perk up and, you know, he would energize him. So we would talk to him a lot about that. And when he would talk about Gilbert, he got so wistful. And he said one day, I wonder whatever happened to him. And so that planted a seed for me. And as a journalist, I went to France to write about the 50th anniversary of D-Day and my father's honor.
Yeah.
And while I was there, this is 1994, again, before email and cell phones, I put a little ad in the paper to try and find Gilbert Duclos. And I didn't even know how to spell his last name. And by the most amazing, lovely providence, we connected on that trip. And it was just one of the most moving experiences
of
my
chills.
Life.
Yeah. And you and his family, he's now deceased, right?
Yeah.
But you've remained close.
Yes. I made a promise when I found him that we would never lose contact, because when he told me that he had never forgotten my father, that he had told first his wife, then his daughter, then his grandsons about this kind lieutenant and how someday someone would come. And that was me. I just got chills. And when I told him that my father never forgot him, he just wept. So, you know, and I had studied French in Southern California when it was not practical at all. You know, I should have been studying Spanish, but right. I could not help myself. I had to learn French. And when I sat with him, he did not speak English. So, and I've kept up with the family. I visit them in normal times every year. Because I write a lot about France. Right. And I was just at the 75th anniversary of D-Day and wrote a ton of articles, two of which got awards, actually. And I stayed with his widow, and there's four generations. I sent a picture, if you want to put it up.
We'll share that at capradio.org. Diane, I have to end it there, but people can read much more about this through the book, right?
Yes.
Nevada City-based award-winning author and journalist Diane Covington Carter, who's been in New Zealand since March because of the pandemic. We thank you so much for getting up extra early on your birthday. So again, a happy birthday to you.
Thank you so much.
Now go enjoy it.
I will. I'm about to.
And find out more about our guests, including Diane, at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight on this Veterans Day. A big thank you from the whole Insight team to all of those who have served our country. Thanks for joining us. I'm Randall White.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.